Okay, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. Welcome to CSIS. It's a great way to start a Monday morning, and thank you all for coming. This is going to be this is going to be one of the most interesting programs that you're going to participate in, probably certainly for this week. And it's really exciting to welcome Governor Huntsman here. I'd like to just relay to all of you a very interesting conversation we had this morning, because we were talking about globalization. And as everyone knows, there's a great deal of fear in the country right now about globalization. At least that's what we think it is in Washington. And frankly, there's a lot of pandering by politicians about the fear. And Governor Huntsman was describing how what he's done in 4 years is to create a very exciting program where Chinese is being taught in many of the schools, Chinese language is being taught in many of the schools. Arabic is right behind it. He said the people of Utah are embracing it. And what it tells you is that, yes, globalization can be a daunting thing, but with effective government leadership, the American public will embrace it and will succeed. And that's what this is really about. This is part of a series that we've been hosting at CSIS, our Smart Power series. And, of course, the question is how does America succeed in engaging in this international era? And we're trying to celebrate the bright spots in the country where this is where we are making a great success out of it, and we're going to listen to that this morning. I think Governor Huntsman's let's just say he's not a typical governor. I mean, he's a Mandarin speaker, you know, and this is a businessman who has entered politics, and it's the very best dimension of leadership at the state level. But he's not been just a state leader. He's been a national leader, too. He was active, I think you deputy the U.S. Trade Representative for a time, and sees that crucial nexus between security and prosperity that's really the foundation of how we're going to succeed in this global era. So we're really delighted to have him here. He's going to share with us the experiences that he has been having as governor in Utah, but also he is very active with the Western Governors Association and is taking them in very productive and exciting new directions. And I hope we hear about that as well. So, Charles, you're going to lead our conversation, but we're first going to hear from the governor. Let me turn it over to you to formally introduce it, and then you can take it from there. Thank you again, Governor. Glad you're here.
I'm Charles Freeman, the Freeman Chair in China Studies here at CSIS. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Governor Huntsman, who I've known in multiple capacities, in addition to watching him prosper as governor of the great state of Utah. I had the great honor and privilege of serving under him at the U.S. Trade Representative as one of his immediate reports in the China shop, where he was the deputy USTR for Asia, Africa, and other parts. And he was, in addition to serving in that capacity earlier in his life, he also was ambassador to Singapore, as well as serving in the Department of Commerce. So he's had a very wide and varied and very distinguished career in both in government and in business and in now state politics. Really a great leader, and someone that is also one of the most decent human beings I've ever had the privilege of knowing. So it's a terrific honor for me to welcome Governor Huntsman back to Washington, and I'm really looking forward to your remarks this morning, and then we'll open it up for some questions. I'm probably going to take the right of a first refusal and ask a couple, but then we'll turn it over to our audience to ask a few more, but Governor Huntsman.
Thanks, Charles.
Thanks.
Charles, I appreciate those kind words. And John, thank you very much for having me here. It really is an honor and a privilege, I've got to tell you. I mean, as somebody who represents kind of the Wild West, to be here at CSIS, I mean, give me a break. I mean, the world is an interesting place indeed. And I'm here with Mary Kay, my better half, who just wonders why her husband has such a hard time keeping a job. And there's probably something to that. But I'm reminded, since we're talking about it, China, Charles, of a great Han Dynasty aphorism that puts it all in perspective for me. You know, the Han Dynasty went from about 200 BC to about 200 AD, during which there was a lot of very progressive development politically and in terms of philosophy and city-state building. And somebody uttered this phrase, Ru jia ting kuai le guo zhi tian ping zhi xia. And every time I see Mary Kay, I think about this very thing. You know, when the family is happy, then all is well under heaven. And so far, all is well under heaven. Thank you. Thank you, Mary Kay, for being here as well. CSIS, I served on the Pacific Forum board many years ago with the likes of Brent Scowcroft and others and thoroughly enjoyed it. And it was kind of an eye into what CSIS does. And I have tremendous respect, John, for you and your programs here. I'm reminded a little bit, having just dropped my son off at the Naval Academy for summer seminar, of Admiral Arleigh Burke, who I think was a person who founded, at least co-founded, this great institution back in 1962 or 63, where back during the war years or the post-war years, when he really made his mark as an admiral, they used to call him 31 Knot Burke. Of course, he used to run at 34 knots as a destroyer captain until they blew a boiler and it killed a sailor in those days, and so he had to throttle back from 34 to 31. So I'm going to try to get through this with about 31 knots and give you a sense of kind of the lay of the land, and then we'll kind of get into any questions that you have. I'm going to give you a snapshot of some of the trends that are influencing the western part of the United States, which I think is the most exciting and dynamic part of the country. I'm moving on next week to become a chair of the Western Governors. So for me, all of this is very germane and relevant right now. 20 Western states that represent, you know, in terms of migration patterns and demographic change and economic vibrancy, certainly the most important part, I would argue, of the United States. And interestingly enough, Utah plays a very interesting role, right, kind of as a crossroads of the West. It's the third fastest growing state in America. Now you're thinking, Utah, third fastest growing state in America? It is true. And we'll get into some of these demographic changes, if you like, in just a moment. But let me just say that we are seeing something in the West that I believe is happening throughout the world. And we're reading about that, of course, if you like demographics or if you like to read about the movement of people. It's a very real phenomenon that's happening. And I was reminded as I took a helicopter flight in the southern part of Iraq recently over Babylon in the Hilla province, you know, which was overtaken by Alexander the Great in 331 BC, probably representing, they called it back then, southern Mesopotamia, then the first real city-state in human history, probably, you know, 3500 BC. And, you know, the world transformed itself to, you know, 300 BC, where we saw a similar kind of city-state that evolved in the Indus Valley region, somewhere close to the Sindh and the Punjab provinces of Pakistan, and then cross-border into India. And in China, what did we see in the development of Canton or Guangzhou, then referred to as Panyu, about 214 BC, a similar kind of city-state that developed, one of the earliest civilizations in China at the time that really represented that whole city-state philosophy. And here in the United States, you know, 1625, New Amsterdam under the Dutch, that, of course, was overtaken in 1664 by the Brits, and, of course, we all know it as New York City today. My parents, born in the 1930s, saw the world population go from 2.7 billion when they were born to where we are today. My kids are living in a world with 6.8 billion people. 2.7 billion to 6.8 billion people. A gradual kind of urbanization that is occurring in all corners of the world. And what are we seeing out in the West? The same thing occurring. Even in our state of Utah, a very interesting urbanization that is taking place. People seeking opportunity, people seeking kind of the vibrancy of the city centers, the economic opportunities that carries with it. And with that kind of movement, not surprisingly, we go from challenge number one, which is population, to challenge number two, which is resource management. You stop and think of it. You know, what are the compelling issues today in the world that people are talking about every day? And we're talking about oil prices. We're talking about energy. We're talking about food. How are we going to feed the populations around the world that are now crying out for help? Morocco, I just read, is that Saudi Arabia? and the UAA for $800 million, a loan to cushion some of the impact from oil and cereal prices. I mean, the things that we're hearing in the world today with respect to the food crisis and the oil crisis are rather unprecedented. We look out west and we see some resource management challenges of our own. In today's world, we might not be talking about food in the West, but we're talking about the most precious commodities of all, things like water and energy. What is it that we're going to do longer term about things like water? In Utah, for example, we use about 260 gallons per person per day. In a world where you could probably use 90 gallons per day and do just fine. So not surprisingly, we have a fairly aggressive conservation effort that is underway. 25% conservation by the year 2050. I hope we get there because our projections when you look at population growth will take us from just under 3 million people where we are today to roughly 6.8 to 7 million people by the year 2058. Now, I've got 2058 in my mind because I've gone around and I've given several graduation speeches at universities and colleges the last few weeks, and I'm thinking, what are these kids going to be stepping out to in the workforce this year? And then what is the world going to be like when they retire, which is going to be roughly 2058? What are going to be some of the most pressing challenges that they have to deal with? And I'm here to tell you that these traditional ways out west of just kind of getting water out of the same old rivers as we have done since the 1920s and 1930s is not going to cut it any longer. I mean, for heaven's sake, Phoenix, Arizona. Phoenix just overtook Philadelphia as the fifth largest city in America. And we've got Clark County, Nevada, which is the fastest growing region of the country. We have our own region, not to mention Denver. And you've got the making for a serious challenge as it relates to water going forward. So, in a state that today is using about 1,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools every day, we try to anticipate what our use is going to be in about 2058 when our usage goes to about 2,700 Olympic-sized swimming pools every day. And you compare that with where Arizona, Nevada, Southern California all find themselves today, massive consumers of water. And we've got to start scratching our heads and coming up with different ideas in terms of how we proceed. Like, number one, reintroducing market mechanisms into water pricing that somehow give a market value to water, something that in the second driest state with the cheapest water anywhere in the country has been loath to do, but we're going to have to rethink this whole assumption. Two, alternative forms of water generation, like desalination. Looking at, for example, the way things are being done in Australia, I sat down the other day with a political leader from Australia and heard what they're doing on desalination. And the technologies that are now being deployed in Perth, in Brisbane, in Cairns, in Sydney, which is on its second desal unit, they've even gone so far in Australia as to put timers in showers, if you can imagine this, 4 minutes. Now, apparently the male population does okay with this. The female population doesn't like it at all. So seriously looking at our water needs and what will need to be done, and I'm here to tell you that, as usual, we're going to have to rely on some really smart people at some very good universities in this country that will come up with some sort of fix on the desalination technology side. Because 50 years from now, the Colorado River, the Green River, the Snake River, the Bear River, and all of those traditional sources of water that feed the West simply won't cut it given where our population growth is going. Two is power, and that is in a state that produced 44,000 gigawatt hours of electricity just this last year, exporting about 40% of it to California, which is a major consumer of our electricity. I kind of look at where our population is going vis-a-vis our electricity needs, and we've got an equation that is absolutely out of balance. I'm here to tell you that in 50 years, when these kids that we're talking to at graduation, 2058, when they retire from their endeavors in life, we're going to be finding that most of our economies are powered by the sun and wind and probably the atom, with some sort of global electronic grid that moves energy in ways that balance the needs of the planet, unlike today. But how is it that we achieve that? I'm not quite sure. I can see exactly where things should go over the next 30, 40, and 50 years, but how we get there is going to take brain power. So what are we doing in the West to try to deal with this reality. 2 years ago, the Western governors established energy goals for the entire region, which is to say the 20 Western states. And it's a pretty wide swath of territory, everywhere from California all the way through to South Dakota. 30,000 megawatts of new clean and diverse energy generation by the year 2015. New clean and diverse energy. Now, this in a region that has traditionally used coal and other carbon-emitting forms of energy. Two, a 20% increase in energy efficiency by 2020. We in the state of Utah have said we're going to go one better. We're going to go 20% efficiency by 2015, which is to say that we've had a very aggressive approach in our state to working the way that new state buildings are architected, our state fleet of thousands of cars and the fuels that they will be running on. Three, adequate transmission capacity for a region that is going to desperately need additional transmission if we're going to be able to embrace renewable forms of energy, as we all know that we can. We're beginning to make some progress, and I'm happy to say that in the West, I think we really are leading the charge in terms of the energy solutions that this country is going to look to going forward. In 2004, the West had about 9,000 megawatts of clean energy generating capacity. By the end of this last year, 13,000 megawatts of clean energy capacity. The 13 Western states have adapted a renewable portfolio standard and set a state goal for renewable generation. This is a thought that was absolutely unacceptable by most participants at the table just a few short years ago, the idea that you would adapt or embrace a renewable portfolio standard. And third, seven of the top wind-producing states are in the West, and in total representing about 75% of the nation's installed capacity. So we look at population trends and migration patterns. Two, we look at basic resources that we all have great concerns about over the next 50 years. Three, and in keeping with this, what this great institution has done in terms of its seven revolutions, which I'm trying to kind of keep to with my brief remarks. Three, technological innovation and diffusion, which is a trend that is a very, very significant one in the western part of the United States. In other words, the basic development of homegrown technology that is changing our world. Now, what have we done as a country that really has been quite remarkable over the last many decades? We have invested heavily in basic research. So it's therefore not surprising that at places like the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, a board where I served many, many years ago, names like Einstein and Oppenheimer and Hirschman and Witten and Bacall, all of whom brought us great insight, great innovation, and great intellectual breakthroughs, is probably looking at kind of a slower pace going forward. In fiscal year 2007, when adjusted for inflation, we saw research and development dollars reduced by nearly 3%, the first such decline since fiscal year 2000. Now let me repeat. I think one of our most important engines of growth in this country has been our commitment to basic research, and we are flat, if not declining. I'm not sure that that says very many good things about the direction of our country. Both research, $55 billion worth, and development, $57 billion worth, are expected to be down from prior year totals, 2.2 and 3.5% respectively. Now, when you combine the commitment to basic research that we have always done so well as a country, and combine that with the free market, which we enjoy in this nation, unlike, I think, any other economy in the world, and you combine the free market with risk and entrepreneurship, that idea that that man or woman is willing to go out and take out a loan and gamble his or her intellectual property in the marketplace as an entrepreneur is an extraordinary thing that you just don't see in every corner of the world. But there's something beyond that that I think really makes us a very, very unique country as it relates to the development of these homegrown technologies. And we're seeing it in Utah, as we're seeing it in Northern California. And that is the idea that people are willing to embrace failure. Now, what do I mean by this? I had a very interesting conversation from somebody trying to describe Silicon Valley recently and trying to hit upon the magic formula that Silicon Valley has and why, in fact, it has been so successful. It has capital. It has kind of that risk and entrepreneurship, that whole culture that it's been built around. It has great institutions of higher learning. But there's something that just doesn't exist in other parts of the world that is quite unique. And it's the idea that failure, failure is accepted. It's an accepted part of doing what entrepreneurs do. Failure is accepted. And so long as we maintain, I think, a commitment to basic research, a free market, risk in entrepreneurship, and a sense that failure is okay at the end of the day, I think we're going to do just fine. Let me name two areas specifically where I think Utah is going to change the economic landscape that today we're looking at. One is in personalized medicine. Now, the areas in which we're really breaking loose in a most remarkable way would include computation, biotechnology, genomics, nanotechnology, and energy. But there are two where I think our state, and by extension, some of the surrounding states in the West, are really going to hit a home run that will impact virtually every state in America. Personalized medicine. And I say this because there's a great academic who just won a Nobel Prize, Mario Capecchi, in our state. He has combined forces with Dr. Mark Leppard in a large-scale genotyping effort that is contributing to the rapid advances in the identification of genes associated with deadly human disease. Now, this means that the woman diagnosed with advanced breast cancer or the man diagnosed with advanced prostate cancer who was given 6 months or a year or 2 years to live will be given a full life. You know, you're diagnosed as, you know, or my sister-in-law died of lung cancer at 32 years of age, left two kids behind. No more death sentences. The kind of breakthroughs that are occurring on the personalized medicine side will give someone with that typically fatal disease the ability to live on and enjoy a quality of life, all based upon a personal DNA readout that helps everyone better understand what we are predisposed toward. My daughter has juvenile diabetes. I have no idea why she has juvenile diabetes. We don't have any autoimmune deficiencies in our family. Yet there is something in our family line somewhere that would have suggested in advance, if we had this kind of personalized medicine information, that would have allowed early intervention in the identification of my daughter or my sister-in-law in high-risk clusters. Out at the University of Utah, personalized medicine is taking off in a most remarkable way. Personal DNA info that is helping in identifying those who have predisposed diseases, are predisposed to certain diseases that in the old days were a death sentence, that we hope in tomorrow's world have the diagnostics and therapies that allow life to be extended. Two, unleashing enormous commercial opportunities and potential as a result of this. And three, contributing significantly to healthcare costs. If you can imagine with this kind of approach to personalized medicine, the implications that this is likely to have in terms of healthcare costs going forward. So when you go into a doctor, as I did last month, and I had rotator cuff surgery, and I wouldn't wish that upon anybody. It's a terrible operation. And the doctor says, we've got to take a picture of your shoulder, and we've got to see if the sutures are healing properly. And I say, what do you want me to do, doc? And he says, well, you have a choice. You can either get an ultrasound, or you can get a CAT scan. And first time in my life I'd ever actually been told that I had a choice in a doctor's office between procedures. And it didn't dawn on me that one of them was $100, the other was $1,000. So the whole idea that we can move toward greater personalized medicine with greater transparency in terms of the options that we have when in the doctor's office or the hospital, I think is going to contribute significantly to the overall healthcare costs. So aside from personalized medicine, I would say that the other revolution that is occurring in our state and throughout the West would have to do with energy. And all you have to do to understand what's happening on the energy front is to knock on Dr. Brian McPherson's door, who is an investigator at the University of Utah who just won a $67 million research project from the Department of Energy. He is the leading light and at the cutting edge of developing carbon capture and sequestration technology, whereby they capture CO2 emissions and pump it down into saline caverns underground. A new and innovative approach to dealing with CO2 emissions, which we all must take seriously. But here is somebody who's actually developing the wherewithal where in the next 5 to 7 years he thinks this will be commercially viable. Now, if you can imagine a carbon capture sequestration technology, given all that is happening here with emissions, and then try to contemplate for a moment what is happening in China and India and their need to deal realistically with their own emissions problems, this could be an absolutely significant breakthrough happening right in our great state of Utah. Number four, the development and dissemination of information and knowledge. I call it simply staying relevant in today's world. We're all trying to stay relevant in today's world. We're all trying to attract investment and expand our economic base such that we can pay the bills. But we're seeing a very interesting phenomenon happen in the world of business that I think is worth mentioning. And in order to put it properly, I think you have to go back to the days of Christopher Columbus, 1492. In those days, the nation state was supreme as it relates to economic development, primacy for economic development, and was the prime player in the economy until, say, 1865, the end of the Civil War, when there were major developments in transportation and in power and communication, where the corporation, which was kind of a new kind of organization, took over from the nation state as a primary actor in economic development. And the corporation remained the primary actor for economic development probably from 1865 all the way through to 1995, when the whole world was wired and, as Thomas Friedman likes to say, Netscape went public. And what was left behind was not a great valuation within the marketplace, a marketplace that lost billions and billions of dollars in terms of the bubble that burst for technology. But what was left behind was the wiring of the world and the ability then for people to plug in on a common platform called the Internet. So now what you find in the West is the ability for entrepreneurs to live anywhere they want and to do business from any destination. Gone are the days when you had to be in San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, London, Singapore, or Tokyo in order to survive if you were dealing with the financial markets. Here are the opportunities to live in the most offbeat, desolate locations in Colorado, Utah, and Arizona from which you can do business and communicate with the rest of the world. So not surprisingly, we're seeing a huge lift upward in our rural economic development and the implications for those who want to get out of the big cities. They want quality of life, the likes of which can't be found in many big cities these days. And having grown up in Los Angeles, I know a little bit about that. But want a rural life that allows them to plug in and still do their work in any corner of the world. Number five is economic integration. And I've seen the work that CSIS has done with respect to economic integration. And all I would tell you is the contours of the world seem to be a lot rougher than we might have imagined at this point. Thomas Friedman, his theory on the flat world, I think is a good one. But when you see the rise of nationalism in Russia, Lebedev and his connections to Putin and the way in which they're making more and more money from the oil trade and what they do with that is anybody's guess. The rise of trade barriers in Latin America, the sense of protectionism in China, the world just ain't as flat as everyone had hoped that it would be. So we are trying to strike out as a state, as I've mentioned to Charles and others, and develop our own foreign policy. Now, this might sound a little bit unique and offbeat for a state to develop its own foreign policy, but after I was elected, we looked at the world and said, our exports are trending upwards significantly. We've gone from practically nothing to $8 billion, and it isn't just sort of the natural resources that traditionally states like ours in the West have exported, but rather goods and services. I mean, we're becoming a major player in the export market. And so let's identify a few countries with whom we can build significant relationships that are meaningful for our population. So we looked around the world, and we came up with four. And today, you know, being one term into our administration, we have very well matured and developed relationships with these four countries. One is Mexico. Our Hispanic population has more than tripled in the last 15 years, and this is a trend that is going to continue. So by virtue of location, people, culture, and natural trade flows, we've developed a very meaningful relationship with Mexico, and it's based on economics and on education and on culture, and all three areas have been covered by way of trade missions and educational links, institution to institution. Second country is Canada, by dint of location. They're just north of where we are. And because they have a great innovative structure for translating basic research into commercial entities, which is exactly what we're trying to do at a couple of our research universities. It's called MARS, and it's at the University of Toronto. And it's the only other such system that exists in North America, so far as we can see, that is anywhere compatible with what we're trying to do. So we've connected on that front, and we've connected with respect to raw materials. They have shale, they have tar sands, and so do we. And if we're going to take energy independence at all seriously, at some point we're going to say, what about the shale? What about the tar sands? And what about developing this in an environmentally friendly way that allows us in a world with $130 per barrel oil prices to kind of enter a new world? The third country is China, because China is China. And the fourth is India, because India is India. It's interesting to note that today in our state, we have more students on a percentage basis studying Chinese and more schools teaching Chinese than any state in America. We've consulted with the Chinese on the Olympics, as we have had it most recently. We are training government officials in the Hainan province. We've invited the Chinese to participate for the first time ever in the Western Governors Association, which will be kind of an historic thing for the WGA. With respect to India, we have clinical trials collaborations with some of our companies in Utah. We're the only governor's mansion in the country that actually celebrates Diwali, which I think is a pretty cool thing. The University of Pune, which is just south of Mumbai, is very interested. Now, let me give you a sense of what this university is. It's a 500,000 student university. So you try to get your mind around the University of Pune, 500,000 students. They're very interested in the role of the community college. They don't have community colleges in India. They're very interested in how we have created community colleges, what roles they play, and how they can organize their own, along with workforce preparation, which is also something that I know in India is going to be important as they go forward. Number six is conflict. Now, I'm not here to talk about conflict in Iraq or conflict in Afghanistan. I'm here to tell you that I'm about this close to declaring or committing our National Guard troops to the border with Nevada. Just kidding. There are very real issues in the West that today we talk about, we joke about, but are going to be very serious issues going forward. Let me tell you what they are. They are water. Now, who would have thought that states would start to, you know, confront one another, stare one another down over water? But there in Nevada, the state to our west, they have to feed these large fountains that are out in front of these great hotels in Las Vegas. They take a lot of water. They're running out of water in Nevada. So conveniently, they can stick a straw on the western side of our border. They can suck water out of aquifers and along with it take a lot of water from our ranchers and farmers in the western part of our state. And I say, over my dead body. And they say, well, we need the water. And I say, over my dead body. You take water from our farmers and ranchers, I don't care if 200 people are living out in the western part of it. It is a lifestyle that we are trying to protect that we're not going to let the fountains in Las Vegas destroy. And so haven't committed the National Guard troops yet, and I don't anticipate doing so. But when you look at what Alabama, Florida, and Georgia went through not long ago with respect to their own water challenges, requiring Dirk Kempthorne, the Secretary of Interior, to actually mediate between the three of them, you get a sense of what is going on. When you talk about climate change, when you talk about emissions, when you talk about power plants that are sited right on our border that put our population right downstream, because everybody is downstream these days, you get a sense of what conflict means, not today, but over the next 50 years, as water does become the most precious resource of all in the West, and we have to deal very realistically with air quality and very realistically with issues regarding climate change. Seventh and finally, let me just say that there's a challenge of governance. And I'm not quite sure what the right governing model is going to be in the years to come, but I'm here to tell you that governing a state, kind of like governing a corporation, is going to take a hybrid model as we go forward. Requires innovation. You're looking at growth issues. You're looking at economic development, funding education, adapting to the big issues of our time. And I'm here to tell you that just the traditional old way of saying no and getting to where we are today, which is tremendous paralysis in this city, by the way, tremendous paralysis in the city. You go out west and we don't quite understand how it can be that way. When you've got issues about with respect to energy, when you've got issues about immigration, the most compelling issues of our time, to have Congress totally and unequivocally abdicate responsibility is totally unacceptable. So what kind of leadership model are we going to need going forward? I don't know, but I'm here to tell you it's going to require some sort of hybrid model. There was an interesting study done at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania, I was giving a graduation speech about 3 weeks ago. And they've quantified exactly what leadership means. And they did it based upon fishing vessels. The captain of a fishing boat actually matters. Leadership matters. Somebody with leadership can actually bring in a variable of 14% more catch than someone who is average. They've studied corporations. So when you stop to think that leadership matters to the tune of 14% up or down, that is significant. And I'm here to tell you that as we move forward, that leadership with respect to the state and local issues is going to be required. And I think a new form of leadership, people who are steeped both in the private sector and in the public sector, who understand how to bring people round the round table as opposed to a square table, where stakeholders can have an equal voice in these processes going forward, will be critically important. Thank you all for having me here today. It's been a pleasure. And now we'll sit down. Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome to the round table.
Thank you. Just as we ordered.
Yeah. No, that was phenomenal, comprehensive, and just what the doctor ordered. And a Wharton grad, so I'm not surprised they had you back to give the speech. You raised a number of issues, and I want to turn to a couple. But you started with climate change, and I want to start there first because I saw last week that there was a study that came out that said only 2 out of 5 Americans are really willing to sacrifice now in the interest of doing something about climate change, and that's very troublesome to I think probably many in this room who are probably very focused on the issue and understand the challenges that we face. But for someone in your position who not only is out there and recognizes this and is leading on the issue, but is also in a state that represents a Western state where the notion of rugged individualism is prevalent and the notion of individuals getting out there and doing what they want to do, whether they're casino owners or ranchers, is first and foremost. How do you lead in a way that is not paternalistic and allows you or whomever is trying to take that role win another election? How do you get to the next step? How do you actually achieve what you want to achieve and stay in office?
Well, I think the whole notion that you're trying to win an election can't be the most salient feature in your life. If people know that you're trying to lead for the sake of leading and make decisions for the sake of what's in the interest of the state, and I've said it very clearly, if I'm not reelected, that's fine. I'll go back to what I love doing. I've got kids and got a great family and many other things to do. And I find that the more you stay focused on the issues at hand, the more people like what you do. But as it relates to climate change, I hope that the Republican Party never becomes the anti-science party. And when I read certain commentaries about climate change or other issues, that sometimes strikes me as a feature that is a very dangerous trend. So what do? You let the facts speak for themselves. I was involved in building a cancer institute a number of years ago. And if 9 out of 10 scientists or 8 out of 10 scientists or 6 out of 10 scientists in the field of molecular biology or cancer research came and said, we think that the following approach is good for colon cancer or prostate cancer or breast cancer, everyone would jump to it and say, let's do it. This represents a very serious body of science. We ought to get it done. But you get the same kind of readout with respect to the scientific community on climate change, and that to me is a fairly compelling presentation of the facts by people who happen to know what they're doing. I'm not a scientist, and I don't do that for a living, but what I can do as a decision maker is look to what the body of science says about a subject. Second, we have the worst air quality certain days of the year of any region in the world. Now, it was very interesting because I was in India recently giving a speech, and the person who introduced me said, this is a governor who comes from one of those states where the air is always clean. You think about Utah, the air is always clean. And I stood up and said, I beg to differ with you, but let me tell you how clean our air is. We have the worst air in our northern region and in the Salt Lake metropolitan area, certain days of the year, worst air quality in the country. So when the air quality becomes deleterious for young and old, it becomes an issue. And people want their elected officials to do something about it. And so not only do I see it as a health issue, as a quality of life issue, because we're getting people investing in our state and businesses expanding. Procter & Gamble just announced their first grassroots manufacturing plant in 30 years in our state because they like quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
Quality of life. That means something to people. Well, if the air quality is impinging on that quality of life longer term, it must be dealt with. But also I see it as an economic development opportunity. I won't name you the company, but we've had at least one, maybe two companies who have decided to come and do business in our state because of our commitment to cleaning things up, our commitment to being ahead as opposed to behind in the discussion on cleaning up 100 years of industrialization, taking seriously the issue of climate change, dealing with renewable portfolio standards, coming up with an energy efficiency program. I think this is good economic development. And I also believe that, like computer software and like biotechnology, I do believe that the so-called green technologies over the next 20 years could very well represent one of our most potent economic development opportunities in this country. And it has implications not only for our country, but for so many others who are right behind us, waiting for a little bit of leadership, waiting for us to kind of lead the way, and having developed the technologies that are deployable, probably finding that those are very, very competitive in the Chinas and the Indias, Brazils and Mexicos of the world that are right behind.
I'm going to open it up to questions from the floor, but let me ask another question. You referred to the paralysis here in Washington and that's perhaps the disconnect between what's going on outside the Beltway and here. And talk a little bit about that. I mean, you know, when I obviously am focused on China, so I watch intently the debate here, and particularly the debate over Chinese investment in the United States and the panic and fear the notion of investment from China sets off here in Washington and Congress focused on what happens if China invests here, what does that mean, versus what happens outside the Beltway. There's a lot of interest, and governor's offices across the country are trying to focus how to attract Chinese investment as a tool of economic growth. How do you square that? I mean, how do you talk to Congress? How do you talk to Washington about what your needs are or the perceptions out there of what you need from foreigners versus what's going on versus here?
I think you find a very interesting thing generationally. I think you find in the emerging generation, of which you are part, I will gladly tell you, the emerging
still
generation,
by a third.
There is a sense that the world is out there and that we are part of it. And it has a lot to do with what is available to the emerging generation, and that is the internet, means of communication, means of travel, and intersecting that were just simply not the case with my parents' generation. Do the older generation then have a bit more xenophobia than the younger generation? Maybe it's less exposure to the world. I don't know quite adequately how to describe it. But with the younger generation, there is a very real sense of wanting to be connected. That sense of isolationism, don't tread on me, we don't want to be part of the broader world, just isn't a reality. And so when you look at our state, the youngest state in America, you know, the average age in our state is 26, 27 years old, third fastest growing state in America, we have a sense of dynamism and energy driven by our young people that very much wants to be relevant and wants to be connected with the world. And I think that's a good thing. The cases need to be made. The reason for connecting with the rest of the world very much have to be made. But once done, I think that our population, just to name one, are very eager and very keen to want to be part of what is happening. I'll just give you one example of that. You know, I had the president of Mexico, Vicente Fox, visit our state last year as part of our relationship building with Mexico. I went down to Mexico City and we signed an agreement whereby we had education and culture and the economy all prominently highlighted as part of a bilateral undertaking. And then he came to our state right during the peak of the discussion on immigration.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most people would have thought that a governor would have been run out of town. Not so. There was instead, of course, people on all sides of this debate, but there was a very, I think, intelligent discussion about Utah and Mexico and where we converge and where we don't and the interests that we share in common. We even took Vicente Fox to speak to our legislature, for heaven's sake. And he addressed, I think the first time ever on U.S. soil, he actually talked about what Mexico was going to do with respect to immigration reform. And I thought it was a very, very nice contribution to the foreign policy dialogue that often doesn't occur here, but rather out in other parts of the country. I mean, Vicente Fox could have showed up here and spoke to Congress. He could have showed up here at CSIS and rolled out his ideas with respect to immigration reform. He didn't. He showed up in Utah, of all places, and spoke to our legislature in the great state of Utah. So I think you find generationally a very eager, younger generation that wants to connect with the world. And that being the case, we have a lot of tremendous opportunities that lie in wait for us.
Are there questions? Yeah.
My name is Martin Apple. I'm very interested in the subject of water, both on a national.
My name is Martin Apple. I'm interested in discussing water, both as a Western governor's and a national's issue. The quality and quantity of water is becoming a major issue across the United States in different places. The problems of creating unification of decision-making are hampered by the fact that we have 26 committees in Congress that have absolute right over water, and they all differ. We have 21 agencies that also have the same. So putting them together becomes something between an impossibility and a joke. Mm. And yet we need that coalition somehow. Mm. The Western governors have created a strategy, the first one, where multiple states have gotten together and tried to create a water strategy. Do you see any way that we could enhance that across the country such that we created a national system of understanding about the fair use of water, creating enough clean water, creating enough water, quality and quantity for the whole United States, because the issues differ. There may be quantity in the West, there may be quality in the East, but we really need to solve these issues because the whole country's about to become engulfed in water wars. Yeah.
This is an issue that I never thought I'd spend a lot of time on when I ran for governor. Now, I just stepped out as deputy U.S. trade representative, and there were the traditional, you know, economic development and education issues that I knew I would be immersed in, no pun intended. I didn't think that water would be one of them. And I hearken back to discussions that I had with my uncles in a small town called Fillmore, which is smack dab in the middle of Utah. It used to be the territorial capital back in the old days. My uncles were a gruff bunch of farmers and ranchers, and they had very pragmatic and realistic attitudes about the world. And I used to visit them as a kid from Los Angeles, you know, where I grew up in Studio City. You know, we used to get days off because the pollution was so bad, you know, going to my local public school. And I'd visit and I'd hear my uncles talk about the importance of water, and it never really struck me that this was a real thing, an important issue. And they all had irrigation waterways in those days, as they still do, that basically keep the farms and the ranches viable. And in this job, I've reflected back on those conversations with my uncles. I was only 10, 12 years old at the time. More than I have any other conversations practically of my entire life. Because what they said in those days is absolutely true today. And I don't know any way to put it. Water is the lifeblood of our lives, economically and in every other way. And if we can't get this one right, we're in real trouble. We're never going to be quite as precarious as Singapore finds itself, because it gets all of its water from Malaysia across the causeway in pipes, and all they have to do is turn it off, and then you're in real trouble. So it's therefore no surprise that the Singaporeans, in terms of science and technology, have really gone some length in figuring out how best to desalinize and deal with their own water needs. Through the Western governors, I will tell you that we are putting water on the table in a very serious way. There are only a couple of things that I really care about as the incoming chair of Western governors. I care about the air we breathe, because I think that's a tremendously important legacy that we're leaving the next generation. You know, what is a legacy anyway? You know, we're all leaving something to our kids and our grandkids, and you ask people what legacy is, and it will always be something different. It's air, or it's water, or it's jobs. You know, I think it's a sense of humanity. We're leaving to the next generation a sense of humanity. It's the way we treat, you know, our land. It's the way that you know, we treat our natural resources. It's the kind of kindness and respect we show toward one another as human beings. That's a legacy as well. But water kind of is the centerpiece to making everything else happen. So as a Western Governors Association, we're going to take it up as we have two or three other issues like climate change and like energy, you know, electrifying the West, which is one of the more complex issues I've ever undertaken. And we're going to talk about the institutions and the policymaking bodies that deal with water today. And we're going to look at the Colorado River Authority and see if that is today relevant or if it's an anachronism. And chances are we as a group of 15 or 20 governors are going to come to some consensus around what we need as the fastest growing states in America, what we need with respect to water policy. We'll then take it up to the National Governors Association, and chances are we'll be able then to take that to Congress and maybe lay out some sort of roadmap. I don't know how it's going to happen any other way. We've looked at Congress, you know, and tried to say, come on, folks, do something on immigration reform, do something on energy, on electrification, and nothing happens. And so what happens? You know, the default position is we as Western governors to take it up in our own right. We'll just do it. And, you know, if we then butt heads or come to cross purposes with Congress, so be it. We're just not going to wait any longer. So water is one of those issues, because with population growth and with water quality and with water availability, which is never a certainty, I mean, I wake up doing something I never thought I'd do. That is measuring precipitation levels in our state. Mm-hmm. I wake up and I ask people about reservoirs. You know, are they up or are they down? I've never talked about that my entire life. And now I'm, you know, with the governor of Utah, the most important thing to me every morning is water. And gladly, this will be a good water year. You know, reservoirs are up. Lake Powell, which is a major tourism destination, will be up 50, 60 feet, which is remarkable. And then what's happening in Arnold Schwarzenegger's state, you know, my colleague in California? They're having a drought. And so it's a very spotty picture in the West, and one that we need a consistent and clear policy for. Over the next year, you're going to see a lot of work on this very, very important issue. And I think we're likely to create a roadmap for U.S. policy that could be a good one.
Yeah, in the back.
Hi, Tom Kalina, 2020 Vision. We work on trying to balance solutions to oil dependence and to climate change. And I welcome your remarks on climate change and energy security you were talking about. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, some of the tensions between those issues that you address and as a leader of your state have to address in terms of setting priorities, which is as you're trying to deal with climate change, clearly all the things you're already doing. And then you also mentioned oil shale and tar sands, which are very climate intensive, but serve an energy security purpose. How do you, again, it's a question of priorities, question of tensions and trade-offs. How do you see those things? You also mentioned nuclear power, and you mentioned water. Nuclear power very heavily demanding on water resources. You know, this is not a gotcha question. This is a real question of how do you balance all these different competing priorities in one state? How do you see that?
It's a great question, and I wish I had the perfect answer, other than to say that when people look at governors, they expect, you know, the lights to come on, and they expect the water to flow, and they expect there to be roads without traffic. And we have to answer when things aren't perfect. And so instead of being in sort of a theoretical world, I live in a world that is, you know, largely driven by practitioners. We're all practitioners. And if we can't make it happen, we can't turn and pass the buck. We're responsible. So I look at the world in which I live, and it's a world typically of 100 percenters. I'm always surrounded by 100 percenters. You've got, you know, the energy folks on one side. You've got environmentalists on the other. And I sit in the middle, and I say, how do I bring these groups together? Talk about the round table here, where each voice is respected. I think typically that has not been the case. And typically there has not been a sense of respect for everyone at the table having these kinds of dialogue. Those days are gone, as far as I'm concerned. In our state and with the Western governors, we take all comers, and we have very, I think, good, meaningful, thoughtful discussions around the round table where everyone is there. The Sierra Club is there, you know, the Nature Conservancy is there, the coal people are there, and we figure out how we're going to go forward. And nobody's going to get 100%. And when you create a renewable portfolio standard for a state like ours that has never contemplated such a move, you bring all people to the table and say, this is where we're going. Some of you are going to like it. Some of you aren't going to like it. Nobody is going to get 100% out of the deal. But this is good for our citizens because it's based on air quality. It's based on economic vitality. It's based on the legacy that we're leaving to the next generation. Now let's figure out how to make it happen. And I've come to find as governor, the most powerful weapon you have is that round table and the ability to bring people into your office without leaving anybody out. Because the minute you do that is when you declare war on somebody and, you know, you find that lawsuits begin to fly. You can get everybody around the table, chances are you can make pretty good progress. So 4 years ago, we were nowhere on these issues. Now we find ourselves probably at the cutting edge with respect to what Western states are doing on the whole range of issues, on the environment, on renewable portfolio stuff, on energy efficiency. And this, you know, in a state that is largely traditionally thought to be a coal state. And so what do we have? We have the CEO sitting at the table saying, I think we can do things a little differently. We have the natural gas people saying, I think we can contribute more. I think we can do things a little differently. You have everyone saying, whatever we do, we want to make sure that we take into account the legacy that we're leaving and the way that, you know, kind of the way that we're dealing with the most precious resource of all, our land. And we have found great success in proceeding like that. And I don't know whether it's a dawning of a new era, whether people are actually now willing to, you know, make the right decisions, knowing that it's going to be a while to make that transition. I'm here to tell you 40 or 50 years, it's going to be the wind and the sun and maybe the atom that will basically, you know, take care of our energy future. The question today is, how do we bridge that? You know, everybody wants, Americans are like this, you know, we want it all now. You know, I want my iPod now, I want instant message right now, you know. My kids, I mean, they're doing three things at a time. They're listening to, you know, the Foo Fighters, and they're sending a message, you know, they're texting all at the same time. And I say, how do you do this? You know, this is absolutely unreal. And so the natural outgrowth from all of that is, you know, I want it now. So the idea that we have to do something that is more Asian in nature, and that is, how do we think long term? How do we bridge the gap between where we are today and where we know we can be in 40 and 50 years? That's the challenge, and that's why the round table is so darn important. And we try to use it as effectively as we can.
This while Asians are becoming more and more like us, unfortunately. Yeah.
Ken Moscow, State Department. Just troubled by something. It was written in your biography that we were candid. It said that, written with some pride, that you're keeping the nuclear threat, the threat of nuclear waste out of Utah. And I wondered, that it does, frankly, it resonates a little bit like a NIMBY problem, not in my backyard. And I wonder, you know, as a leader, when you meet with the other Western governors, how you address issues of that sort.
Well, if we benefited at all from nuclear power, if we created jobs as a result of nuclear power, I think it would be looked at a little bit differently. But we don't benefit at all. We are seen as the wasteland in which you can just bury nuclear waste. Why is it that those who are benefiting from nuclear energy don't bury it in their own backyard? Why is it they have to send it out to Utah, Nevada? So I've taken a position on it. I campaigned on it 4 years ago. And people feel very strongly about it in our state. I'd say it's one of these 90-10 issues, 80-20 issues. And I think in Nevada it's probably the same. And that's why Yucca Mountain has encountered such resistance. And so, you know, do we get to on-site reprocessing or storage that allows, you know, us to kind of fill that void between where we are today and allow science to, you know, catch up to wherever we need to be in terms of true on-site reprocessing? I don't know. But if we're not at all benefiting from nuclear power or the creation of jobs around nuclear power, I'm sure not going to deal with nuclear waste in our state. Travel and tourism is a big part of who we are. We promote our lands, which are, I think, the most beautiful on display in the United States, and the idea that somehow that would be compatible with dumping nuclear waste is just something that I can't get my mind around. So they'll have to wait for some other governor to come in and open that back up again, which I hope never happens.
Yeah, in the back.
I'm Elizabeth Pickering from the National Defense Intelligence College. I'd like to go back to the round table and ask, how do the people who don't get their 100% and perhaps only get 70 or 50 or 40, how do you compensate them or how do you bring them along? Or is it too early to ask that question in some concrete example form? You know, the don't gets are certainly part of the problem at the national level when we do compromise.
When you find that you're going from 100 percenters to those who are somehow embracing the middle, everyone has to give up something. And if those on each side see that the other side is, in fact, giving up something, I think they're more likely to accommodate the longer-term plan.
I just wondered if any of that had happened yet and if there are some concrete examples about compensation
just,
or
just,
or
for example, a renewable portfolio standard, for them, you know, where we're trying to go from a state that has very little in the way of renewable energy to, you know, 15 or 20% by 2020, 2025. This is a huge ask. And everyone has to give a little bit. You know, on one side, they want a more aggressive portfolio standard. On the other side, they don't want to give up anything at all. They just want to keep on doing it the old way, you know, with cheaper forms of energy. And both sides give up a little bit to embrace a standard that we have all kind of put on the table and embraced and now rolled out and announced not only to our state but the Western region. And there are several states in the West who have done the same thing. And so far, so good. And I think it's been successful because you've seen parties on both sides of the issue recognize that everybody has to give up just a little bit as we move forward. We're moving into, you know, uncharted territory, and the world's going to look a little bit different. And if you've got to give up and you see that somebody on the other side of the negotiating table has to give up something as well, I think everyone's willing to kind of move toward the middle and get the right policy enacted. So far, we've been successful in getting that done, and it might be that language plays a role here. You know, is it a renewable portfolio standard, or is it a renewable portfolio initiative that people are working toward more on a voluntary basis? And we have found that by using the word initiative, it brings in a lot more people than using the word standard, where people think that it's forced from the top down. An initiative is basically work from the bottom up. And I'm finding that members of the private sector are more willing to participate in an initiative where they can drive things and they can be part of designing the overall fix. They don't see it as kind of a government, a heavy mandate from the governor's office. So we're kind of toying a little bit with nomenclature, with language, how we phrase things. And that means a lot, too, to people, interestingly enough, going forward. But this is all very new. We're a year or two into it. And it'll be interesting to check in the next 3 to 5 years to see how we're doing.
Just up here.
Hi, I'm Laurie Evans. I'm actually born and raised in the great state of Utah.
Great.
And I'm currently with UN ECLAC just across the street. You mentioned your discussion with President Fox about Mexico's immigration reforms. And as you know, it's kind of one of the big issues of the current election is U.S. immigration reform. And I just, you know, being from Utah, I know that we have a healthy Mexican population and it's part of our economy, the workforce that they provide. And I'm just wondering what you think is the best, our immigration reform, how that would be best for our state.
I don't know if you can necessarily address it on a state-by-state basis, but rather a regional basis. And recognizing that the current system is broken and that we need something beyond what currently is available. And I think having an understanding with the government of Mexico that allows a flow of people commensurate with our economic needs. I think if you look back in the post-World War II period, there was an attempt at one point to try to match the flow of immigration with our workforce needs. And I think that's not a bad idea. And if there is proper documentation, a verifiable identification card that can be used, I think that's another very, very important feature. But most important is going to be, you know, economic development on the Mexican side of the border. And I think Vicente Fox put it quite right in saying that we've got to create so many hundreds of thousands of jobs every year to keep people in our country. But I think what Mexico's finding, and this hasn't been talked about very much, is the brain drain that has occurred over the last many years. Economic development in Mexico could likely be hampered because of the people who have left the country and now find themselves in the United States. So the challenge for Mexico could very well be, how do we try to bring people back to take advantage of the economic opportunities that might take place in Mexico over the next 10 years. But I think we also have to be wise enough to know that the fix must encompass all forms of immigration. I mean, we're looking south of the border today, and we're going to be looking maybe in 10 or 20 years at the subcontinent. at sub-Saharan Africa, at every corner of the world, because we are a haven for freedom. And in all that we do, I think this discussion needs to be led first and foremost by a sense of humanity. We all share a common sense of humanity, no matter which side of the border that we are on. And that is so lost in the debate. And I guess I say that, you know, with deeper feelings, having a daughter from China and a daughter from India. You know, we all share a common sense of humanity, regardless of where we reside in the world. Number two, I think rule of law must be part of this debate. Three, safety must be part of the debate. And four, economic vitality must be part of the debate as well. It can be done. I've seen proposals that have been put forth in Congress. In fact, I led an effort with Governor Napolitano of Arizona. We kind of co-chaired an effort to come up with our own Western governor's approach to dealing with immigration. Came back and presented it to Congress, and it was, you know, part of that more comprehensive look at dealing with the issue, which wasn't to be, obviously. But let's hope that whomever occupies the White House after November gets serious about this issue very, very quickly.
Hi, my name is Brett Baptist, and I am an intern here at CSIS and also a native of the great state of Oklahoma. And I'm wondering if you're seeing your state a tension between your rural and urban citizens, and if so, as you were talking about the dynamic nature of your population, and if so, are you seeing that inhibiting your efforts at all these problem-solving initiatives?
The urban-rural tension. What we're finding in our state is a changing landscape, and driven mostly by the mobility of economic development these days, where it doesn't only happen in the research parks around the big universities or in the industrial zones that we set aside specifically for manufacturing. In today's world, you know, entrepreneurs can go anywhere, and we have seen in our rural areas a huge pickup in economic activity. So in the old days, when the rural representatives used to come to the governor and say, what are you going to do for me this year? How much money are you going to give me for, to compensate us who live in the rural areas? I say, what are you going to do for yourself? What are you going to do in terms of attracting the entrepreneurs who would love to live in your corner of the state? You've got fresh water, you've got clean air, you've got lovely mountains. Anybody would love to live there. People just don't know about it. And anyone can plug in and do business from your corner of the state as they can any corner of the world. So there is a thinking in our state that the rural folks can run as fast as the urban folks in terms of economic development. In fact, I mentioned this Procter & Gamble plant, which is in a county called Box Elder County in the northern part of our state, which has seen more economic development than any of the urban areas. We've had like three or four major investments that have gone into this part of the state. And you know what it's done? It's taken the average per capita income from $30,000 up to $60,000. So everybody's happy, and people are saying, wow, we never thought, you know, we'd ever see this kind of economic uplift. And you're seeing some of the old farm families that, you know, with some regret and reluctance are giving over their old farmland to manufacturing, but their families just aren't in the farming business any longer. So you're seeing that kind of transition take place very, very quickly. Two, you're seeing a major upswing in travel and tourism, where we have today a generation of people who want to go not to the traditional destinations, but they want to go hiking and mountain biking and climbing and camping in the most remote parts of the Western United States. So we've gone from 17 million tourists per year to 20.2 million tourists per year this last year. I've set a new goal of 25 million tourists over the next 3 to 4 years, and we're going to get there. And a lot of it's driven by the outdoor enthusiasts who love kind of the unspoiled land. And so not surprisingly, we've heard from some of these rural counties who have said, we're getting travel and tourism opportunities. This has been a good thing for the state, and we're helping to promote jointly with certain rural areas. We've got a co-op program for promoting travel tourism. So that seems to be working reasonably well. But we're also finding that people want to live in the rural areas like never before. And I think it's this sort of connectedness that you can do business from any corner of our state. And as we move forward, with respect to these migration patterns moving largely into the city centers, you get a lot of people who are now saying, I just don't want to live here any longer. This is becoming too much like Southern California. I think I want to move out to that rural area. So you're seeing property values that are increasing as a result of that whole transition. And that's a dynamic that I'm going to keep my eye on over the next 10 or 20 years, because I think we're going to see some very interesting migration flows into these traditional rural towns that thought they'd never see any signs of life forever. And you're seeing some very interesting migration patterns into these areas that really are kind of moving the economy upward in a very interesting way.
Just here, sir.
My name is Buck Ravel. I'm from Texas, and we raise a few cows down there. You do too, you have them in Utah, too.
We sure do.
Having experience in the trade issues, what's going on in Korea right now really bothers me. The mad cow disease and the mass demonstrations that are going on against a really non-existent problem. And yet we see Hyundai automobiles, LG appliances, Samsung electronics, and so forth. So there's an issue of open trade, and there's an issue of fair trade. And when a false issue can essentially stop a government from engaging in the creation of a trade agreement, it gives me some concern that we don't seem to have a position to go back and say, you people aren't really looking at the totality of what's good for Korea and what's good for the United States. And I think you could apply the same thing to China and India on certain issues.
So specifically, the question is what?
The question is, how do we, as a nation, deal with an irrational response on the part of a population that harmfully affects our trade at the same time they want trade advantages from us?
I think we can do no more than expect basic reciprocity and realize that this issue will pass in time. And having done the trade beat before, the issue we're seeing in Korea now over beef, I guess it's over beef, I haven't followed it like I used to follow years ago. Every trading partner we have will have the beef issue at one point in our trading relationship. We have to decide if longer term these relationships are worth building. And I'm absolutely convinced the relationship with Korea is worth building and moving toward, you know, the completion of an FTA with. If it's in our long-term interest to stay engaged, we ought to stay engaged. And realizing full well that we're going to have these hiccups along the way, and I guess they could serve to decimate or ruin the relationship, but we either see them as being in our interest longer term or not. And if they are in our interest, as is the case with Korea, I think we need to, you know, I think we need to continue moving forward in carefully identifying our interests. It's also interesting to note that, you know, there are players in Asia that have matured over time, partners with whom we had the same kind of disruptions from time to time. And as they kind of climb the economic development ladder, we find that we have a much more harmonious trading relationship over time. Taiwan is a perfect example where, you know, I remember back in the late 80s, you know, we had enormous problems with Taiwan in a range of areas that where today most of those have been taken care of. It's been in our long-term interest to remain engaged. And I would say the same about most of the countries of Asia. It all depends upon our will to hang in there. Reciprocity, pressure, all of these things are important. But I think longer term, the relationship with Korea is a very, very important one.
Got time for a couple more questions just here in the middle.
Hi there. My name is Danielle Iavone, and I'm a specified intern with the Canadian Embassy. You mentioned Canada among your state's top four countries that you're building relationships with. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on some of the, I guess, subnational linkages that are taking place or what you would like to see materialize in the future.
I don't know that we've done enough to recognize two important areas in our relationship with Canada that likely could serve to bring us closer together from a basic research and development standpoint, if nothing else. One is what is taking place in Toronto with respect to the Mars program at the University of Toronto, where there is, I think, an unprecedented effort to take basic research and translate it into commercially viable entities. This is something that every university in America could learn something from. I've gone up there to visit with their premier. I've gone to the campus to visit with some of their faculty members to see exactly what they're doing. I took a group of higher ed people with me so they could kind of tune into this remarkable work that's being done at this MARS program. And I thought, you know, this has such wide-ranging applicability, not only for our state, but for every state in America, because there is something called a logjam in every technology transfer office at practically every research university in America. They're big and they're bureaucratic and they're very cumbersome. And we've produced a lot of great intellectual property in this country, but we have a very difficult time getting it through that sieve called the Technology Transfer Office and onto commercially viable entities, which we're trying to do in our state. We've kind of changed that process where it's now somewhat expedited. But we learned a lot from our experience with the MARS program in Toronto. And given the strength of our biotechnology sector in the United States and the biotechnology sector right across the border and the way in which together we can move toward conquering human disease a lot faster than doing it unilaterally, there is reason to come together around this very important cluster, and the sooner the better. Two is the energy economy. Now, not surprisingly, I'm mentioning, I think, the two most important industry sectors of our time, and they just happen to fall very nicely in our relationship between the United States and Canada. You've got health sciences, biotechnology, healthcare, and then you've got energy. And when you look at the work that has been done around the Calgary area with tar sands and shale, they're well ahead of where we are in terms of the technologies that have been used to try to take these raw materials and in an environmentally friendly way make them commercially viable, well ahead of where we are. And who's my closest friend among the diplomats in our region? It's the Consul General of Canada. Because of these two areas that we have a profoundly deep interest in, and so does every other state in our region. So if we could somehow strengthen our relationship with respect to energy opportunities, new sources of energy, our energy independence, and then turn to curing human disease in ways that expedite the clinical trial basic research process that we're both trying to work on, but together I think we could do it with much greater speed and efficiency, that'd be a hugely significant thing between the United States and Canada. I'd love to see both those areas ratcheted up significantly. We're trying to do it in our own little state, but we're not the United States of America. We're just a small part of it.
Canada's also got an awful lot of water, but we don't want to go there. So let's make this the last question. Yeah, just here.
Shannon Pemberthy with Procter & Gamble, and just thank you so much for the mentioning you have today of our new facility. It's going to be built in Box Elder County. We just broke ground last month, and I just wanted to comment on, I think, for the group, kind of the pragmatic, the reality-based, the fact-based approach to solving these all critical issues, particularly coming from the governor, was very instrumental in our decision to locate there. Anytime you're going to put in a major manufacturing facility, all these things come into play, our need for natural resources in the area. The administration, quite frankly, pushed us a lot on what was our environmental impact going to be. And at every point, though, we realized that these were all values that, based on our common sense of humanity, were values of our company and then best interest and led to us making that decision. So thank you for your role. That it's very much appreciated and known throughout the company globally of the instrumental role that you played in that.
Well, thank you very much, and let me just tell you very quickly that the impact that your investment, which is significant, will have on our state is something that our citizens take great pride in, because not only is there Procter & Gamble, but you've got suppliers, and you have customers, and you have all the peripheral industries that build up around a manufacturing site of this size, not to mention the impact it has on our local schools and higher education institutions. And the custom fit training that we are now embarking upon to ensure that there is a workforce that is ready to meet your needs going forward, which is a very, very exciting feature in many of the local communities around Box Elder. So thank you for making it happen.
Thanks, Governor Huntsman. And please join me in thanking Governor Huntsman for...
Thanks. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Mary Kay, for lending John this morning, and thanks, everybody, for coming. Have a great week.